This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes Creative Commons licensed talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on December 20th of 2005. It contains John's commentary on Chapter 18, The Impossible Victory, Vietnam.
This is The Impossible Victory, Vietnam, and I tried to synthesize a great deal of material from other reading that I've done on Vietnam from Zinn. The first U.S. armed intervention in Vietnam actually was in 1845 when the USS Constitution, you remember the USS Constitution, a lot of us read about the USS Constitution in our high school textbooks. The USS Constitution attempted to force the release of a French bishop. We won't ask what French bishops were doing thousands of miles from France, but French colonialism dates from its invasion of southern Indochina in 1858. And complete occupation by 1884. Organized resistance, truly organized, systematic resistance against the French began in the 1930s, led by Ho Chi Minh and the Indochinese Communist Party. Ho Chi Minh was the greatest figure in the Vietnamese independence movement. A communist and nationalist, he had lived in England, where he helped organize an anti-colonial group that championed independence for Ireland. He had lived in the U.S. He actually shoveled snow one winter in Harlem. And he lived in France, where he became a co-founder of the French Communist Party. Constantly in and out of jail in the 1920s and 1930s for his revolutionary efforts in Vietnam, Ho built up a corps of allies and guerrillas led by a former history teacher, Vo Nguyen Giap, who had become Ho's military strategist for 30 years until the end of the war in 1975. They founded the Vietnamese Independence League, or the Viet Minh, in May 1941 to lead the Vietnamese in a common struggle against the Japanese, who had taken over Vietnam in 1940, and the French. In 1945, actually, was the first U.S. combat death in Vietnam. It occurred during the anti-colonial struggle against the French. An OSS officer who had been sent to work with the Viet Minh was killed in an encounter with French troops. The OSS, or the Office of Strategic Services, was the forerunner of the Central Intelligence Agency. When the Vietnamese declared their independence from France in September 1945, they took the opening lines of their declaration from our Declaration of Independence. U.S. representatives were given a special place of honor, and Major Archimedes Patty of the OSS stood next to General Giap on the platform. In 1945 and 1946, Ho Chi Minh repeatedly cabled or wrote President Truman requesting recognition for Vietnamese independence. He never received a response. The Vietnamese independence was short-lived, however, as the U.S. allowed British and Chinese troops to occupy Vietnam at the end of World War II. The British released and rearmed 5,000 troops who took control of Saigon, and by the end of 1945, France had 50,000 soldiers in southern Vietnam. There was a temporary pause in the conflict in March 1946 when France signed an agreement with Ho Chi Minh recognizing the Republic of Vietnam as a free state within the French Union. This established Ho Chi Minh's government as the only legal and legitimate government in Vietnam. However, this agreement ended almost immediately when the French set up a puppet regime in southern Vietnam and shelled Haiphong in northern Vietnam, killing an estimated 6,000 people. The Vietnamese, under the Viet Minh, then renewed armed struggle against France and the United States for the next 30 years, until April 30, 1975. In May 1954, despite massive U.S. aid, which was about $1 billion in actual economic aid and arms by then, or 80% of the total war costs, the French were dealt a crushing military defeat at Dien Bien Phu, and what was known as the French Indochina War was over. This led to the Geneva Agreements, which called for French withdrawal and free elections in 1956 to reunify the entire country. Elections that all knowledgeable observers, including Eisenhower himself, knew would lead to an overwhelming victory for Ho Chi Minh and the Communists. The Geneva Agreements, therefore, were immediately subverted as the U.S. imposed the client regime in what came to be called South Vietnam, with Ngo Dinh Diem as puppet leader. As the Pentagon Papers state, South Vietnam was essentially the creation of the United States. Lacking popular support, the Diem regime resorted to large-scale terror and thereby provoked resistance it could not control in the South. The planned 1956 elections were the condition under which the Viet Minh had accepted the accords and stopped fighting. This is an absolutely vital point because the Viet Minh would have beaten the French militarily and would have liberated the entire nation had the war against the French continued. When President Kennedy took office in 1961, the U.S. supported Diem regime faced imminent collapse. Therefore, Kennedy escalated the attack on South Vietnam to prop up Diem rather than face a humiliating loss and withdrawal. U.S. planes were sent to South Vietnam to fly missions with South Vietnamese in support of Diem's ground forces, and planes for chemical warfare, what we know as Agent Orange, were also authorized, as well as helicopters that could be outfitted for use against food crops. Kennedy increased the number of U.S. advisors from a few hundred to 16,500 troops. This aggression was no secret, as in March 1962, officials announced that U.S. pilots were engaged in combat missions with armed helicopters assisting South Vietnamese operations. The brutal violence against South Vietnamese was also no secret, and no Kennedy official, the best and the brightest, we remember, no Kennedy official opposed it, even though huge numbers of NLF supporters were killed, wounded, or captured by the U.S. military and bombing campaign. Military and government officials were pleased with Kennedy's escalation of the war and believed that these moves would lead to a quick victory and U.S. withdrawal. By mid-1963, however, Diem's repression had provoked large-scale urban protests in addition to resistance in rural areas. And his regime was actually calling for a reduction of the U.S. role or even U.S. withdrawal. It even made overtures for a peaceful settlement with the North, something that clearly was not in the U.S. interest. Given the U.S. commitment to victory, therefore, the Kennedy administration moved forward to overthrow its client Diem in favor of a military junta that would be fully committed to the war. The planned coup against our client Diem took place on November 1, 1963. Diem was murdered at that time. 3 weeks later, John Kennedy was assassinated. Lyndon Johnson's presidency was marked by a number of things. The alleged Tonkin Gulf attacks against U.S. destroyers in August 1964, escalation of the war in spring 1965 throughout Vietnam, the NLF-led Tet Offensive in January and February of 1968 that led to a review of U.S. policy, and Johnson's announcement that he would not stand for re-election, and the beginning of peace talks in Paris in the spring of 1968. Johnson used the Gulf of Tonkin incident to enlarge the war. North Vietnamese PT boats had responded to one of the repeated U.S. and South Vietnamese attacks on their coastline by engaging U.S. destroyers. The public, however, was told that on two separate occasions, without provocation, North Vietnam's torpedo boats attacked the destroyers and the destroyers returned fire in international waters. As revealed by the Pentagon Papers, however, the U.S. had been carrying out secret military attacks against North Vietnam for at least 6 months prior to the Tonkin Gulf incident and more than 1 year before North Vietnamese forces were even sighted in South Vietnam. Only two members of Congress voted against the Tonkin resolution, Senators Greening of Alaska and Morris of Oregon. That resolution gave LBJ the support he needed for a wider war and served as a substitute for a declaration of war. At that time, presidential advisor Walt Rostow summed up the administration's belief in having the Tonkin Gulf Pearl Harbor. Sound familiar? Like 9/11. Quote, "We don't know what happened, but it had the desired effect. Congress once again abdicated its war-making power as mandated by the Constitution." There was no declaration of war. Since 1945, the United States has been involved in literally hundreds of armed conflicts abroad without a single declaration of war by the Congress as mandated by the United States Constitution. Even more devastating than the bombing escalation in North Vietnam, however, was the far greater bombing in the South that few knew about. By 1966, it was three times greater than in the North. French scholar Bernard Fall stated that what changed the character of the war was not the decision to bomb North Vietnam, not the decision to use ground troops in South Vietnam, but the decision to wage unlimited aerial warfare inside the country at the price of literally pounding the place to bits. The worst devastation in the U.S.-Vietnam War was always in the South. With free fire zones, bombing and napalm, the CIA Phoenix assassination program, which included the torture of thousands of people, and atrocities such as My Lai, which was merely the most reported massacre of the war. A massacre on the same day as My Lai in a nearby village was not even reported, as so many others. By 1966, however, it was becoming clear that despite massive violence and bombing campaigns throughout Vietnam, things were not going well. Former Kennedy advisor Arthur Schlesinger Jr., a big supporter of the war initially, expressed concern that widening it had dubious prospects. Though, quote, "We may all be saluting the wisdom and statesmanship of the American government," end of quote, "if Johnson's escalation succeeds, even if it leaves," quote, "the country gutted and devastated by bombs, burned by napalm, turned into a wasteland by chemical defoliation, a land of ruin and wreck, with its political institutional fabric pulverized." He then added, "No thoughtful American can withhold sympathy as President Johnson ponders the gloomy choices which lie ahead." Something must have been wrong with a lot of us at that time, because we withheld a lot of sympathy from President Johnson in 1966. As other Cold War liberal apologists for the war, Schlesinger only turned against it when the slaughter was not effective. Moral concerns had nothing to do with it. The light at the end of the tunnel ended with the Tet Offensive in Vietnam in January and February 1968. Coupled with this, domestic protest and the deterioration of the U.S. economy convinced domestic elites that the U.S. should move toward disengagement. The attacks had a strong impact on U.S. public opinion, and for the first time, the mass media began to criticize the war overtly. but only tactically. They never questioned its fundamental premises or the noble intentions of our leaders. Noam Chomsky states that after the Tet Offensive, the effect of the policy change on the ideological system here was dramatic. Everyone suddenly turned out to be an early opponent of the war, in secret, however, since no record can be found. Richard Nixon was elected president in 1968, and he tried to Vietnamize the war, as Eisenhower and Kennedy before him, by cutting U.S. troop strength, increasing the technology of destruction, and using South Vietnamese forces. It did not work. And on January 27, 1973, a peace agreement was signed that ended the bombing, withdrew U.S. troops, and released our POWs. As with the Geneva Accords in 1954, however, the U.S. and its client regime in South Vietnam subverted the agreement. This provoked a military response by North Vietnam and the end of the war and U.S. involvement on April 30, 1975. Since 1975 and the end of the shooting war, there has been an ideological campaign in the mass media and political system to portray the war as a noble effort that went astray. Anthony Lewis, leading liberal writer for the New York Times for many years, asserted that the war began with blundering efforts to do good. But by 1969, it had become clear to most of the world and most Americans that the intervention had been a disastrous mistake. The public evidently did not share this mistake view, as it held the war to be fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. An attempt was also made to portray the mainstream media, which always loyally supported the crusade, as opponents of the conflict. They supported U.S. violence throughout, despite the myth that they exposed government lies. What they exposed was the failure of tactics to achieve the violent ends they fully endorsed. For example, the day the Pentagon Papers were released, June 13, 1971, revealing decades of lies and distortions, James Reston of the New York Times, perhaps the most influential journalist of his era, described as persons of unquestioned personal moral character, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, and presidential advisors Walt Rostow and the Bundy brothers. Media critic James Aronson states that this is a strange characterization for men who deliberately deceive the American public in order to continue killing more than 2 million Indochinese and Americans. By 1972, these public figures, these esteemed figures, had gone on to become president of the World Bank, McNamara, professor and head of the Center for International Law at the University of Georgia, Dean Rusk, president of the Ford Foundation, McGeorge Bundy, editor of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Powerful Council on Foreign Relations, his brother William Bundy, and professor at the University of Texas, Walt Rostow. They did not spend a minute in prison for war crimes that they committed against the Vietnamese people. Howard Zinn states that the greatest anti-war movement in U.S. history played a critical part in bringing the war to an end. Its role was critical, certainly, but not when compared with the resistance of the Vietnamese and within the U.S. military itself. Many Americans believe that opposition to the Vietnam War began with student protests in 1965. But those protests actually began 20 years earlier, in 1945. After Japan was defeated, some troop ships bringing GIs home were diverted to transport French troops and legionnaires back to Vietnam. Crewmen on these ships vigorously condemned the use of U.S. vessels to carry, quote, combat troops to engage in hostilities to further the imperialist policies of foreign governments when there are American troops waiting to come home. The entire crew of four ships condemned the government for helping to subjugate the native population of Vietnam. Another of the beliefs during the Vietnam War was that the deepest and strongest anti-war sentiment in the United States was found among the educated classes in this country. But opinion polls and referenda taken as the war escalated under President Johnson showed that such sentiment was greatest among the least schooled and working class sectors of society, not the educated elite. Noam Chomsky points out that by the late 1960s, much of the public was opposed to the war on principled grounds, unlike the educated elite that kept largely to pragmatic objections of cost, that is, what was the cost to the U.S.? Thousands of Vietnam vets came home and became involved in the anti-war movement, as well as in Vietnam. The solidarity between the citizen and veteran anti-war movements was undermined and the anti-war movement at home demonized, however, by the lie that activists attacked returning GIs from Vietnam. Isolated incidents may have occurred, but there is not one press, airport security, police or court record, diary entry, or photograph to support this fabricated myth, as Jerry Lemke, Vietnam veteran and sociologist, has shown in his fine book, The Spitting Image. The most powerful anti-war movement came from within the military. Writing in the Armed Forces Journal in June 1971, Colonel Robert D. Heinel Jr. concluded, quote, "Morale, discipline, and battle-worthiness of the armed forces are lower and worse than at any time in this century and possibly the history of the United States." He went on to state that, quote, "By every conceivable indicator, our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers, drug-ridden and dispirited, we're not near mutinous. It was the collapse of and resistance within the military, coupled with the Vietnamese struggle against foreign aggression, that ended that war, not the domestic anti-war movement." What are some of the lessons of the Vietnam War? Scholar and anti-war activist and former Air Force veteran Bruce Franklin argues that the Vietnam War shocked and then transformed many aspects of American society. Many citizens who began with the naive belief that the Vietnam War was some kind of wayward mistake by a nation long leading the march to progress discovered instead that the war was yet another sordid example in the nation's history from colonial settler regime to global empire. After the war ended in 1975, the United States was the only major nation to withhold diplomatic representation to Vietnam. Noam Chomsky states, quote, "In one of his sermons on human rights, President Carter once explained that we owe Vietnam no debt and have no responsibility to render it any assistance because the destruction was mutual." Chomsky says, "Although this was one of the most astonishing statements in history, it created no stir among educated Americans and did not diminish Carter's standing as patron saint of human rights." The devastating effects of the U.S.-Vietnam War continued far beyond 1975. In addition to the human cost figures I shared with you, U.S. scientist Arthur Westing, perhaps the leading U.S. authority on ecological damage in the war, shows that the land itself was also targeted. Extensive regions were turned into moonscapes, and the massive and sustained expenditure of herbicidal chemical warfare agents against the fields and forests of South Vietnam resulted in a large-scale devastation of crops, in widespread and immediate damage to the inland and coastal forest ecosystems, and in a variety of health problems among exposed humans. The U.S. also engaged in an embargo against Vietnam for 2 decades after the war ended. It cut off not only the legal supply of American goods, but also aid from the World Bank, the IMF, and other lending agencies. Some final thoughts. Zinn argues that one of the fundamental lessons of the Vietnam War is that the U.S. lost its good name, not only in the rest of the world, but also among Americans. The war illuminated the whole political landscape, and what the public learned went far beyond what happened in Vietnam. Many Americans learned that government leaders could not be trusted. They began to suspect the most reputable of national institutions of moral failure. He goes on to say that since 1975, the establishment has tried strenuously to reestablish the public's confidence in the system. With a few exceptions, the money available for films, the acceptability of textbooks for school committees, and the uncritical patriotism nurtured here long before the Vietnam War seemed to conspire to mangle the truth and deceive an entire generation. Writing at the end of the war, in spring 1975, Chomsky asserted that the same forces who attempted imperial domination of Vietnam and who suffered a stunning defeat would now attempt to explain this defeat to the American people, who are a much less resilient enemy. Here, the prospects for success are much greater. The battleground is ideological, not military. The leading intellectuals will work to see that no wrong lessons are learned from the war or the resistance to it. It will be necessary to pursue the propaganda battle with rigor and enterprise to reestablish the basic principle that the use of force by the United States is legitimate if only it can succeed. These intellectuals may concede the stupidity of American policy and even its savagery, but not the illegitimacy inherent in the entire enterprise. Bruce Franklin asserts that denial has been, in every sense, the term necessary to fathom the depths of deception and delusion essential to America's war in Vietnam. He believes that the various forms of denial of the Vietnam War and the people, history, culture, and even the very nation of Vietnam have spread wide and deep in American politics, psychology, and culture. He reviewed the three main competing American stories that we have been told about the Vietnam War. It was a noble cause, it was a quagmire, it was imperialism. The noble cause narrative begins sometime after 1954 when one country, North Vietnam, supposedly attempted to take over another country, South Vietnam. According to this story, the U.S. came home without a victory because the military had been denied the permission to win. This view of the noble cause being lost because of shackling our military closely resembles the underlying argument of Volume 1 of Hitler's Mein Kampf when he discusses the problems after World War I and Germany's loss. The quagmire story, originally told by journalist David Halberstam and others in the 1960s, also begins in 1954, when a reluctant U.S. chose to back the Diem regime and we found ourselves caught in a limited, ineffective, and almost certainly doomed holding action. The imperialism story begins in 1945, according to Franklin, when America's leaders committed the nation to domination within the free world. After World War II, global imperialism, led by the U.S., faced its most direct challenge in Vietnam. The first European colony to emerge from the war with a claim of independence, a national government, and its own army. Franklin is right, quote, "The imperialism story is the only one that adequately accounts for U.S. military, political, and economic warfare against Vietnam and hostility toward every other colony and former colony that has resisted the American Empire." Daniel Ellsberg, who liberated the Pentagon Papers from the RAND Corporation here in Santa Monica, states that when he finished reading the Pentagon Papers, he understood at last that the war was one war. There wasn't a French war, followed by a Vietnamese war and an American war. There was one war that we had participated in from the beginning, and it was a war that we had never had any right to be in at all, any more than the French did. Perhaps we'll leave the final word to historian Gabriel Kolko, someone I would argue is the preeminent scholar on war and imperialism in the 20th century, who asserts that as we look back on the 10,000-day Vietnam War, the longest in United States history, we see, quote, how devious, incorrigible, and beyond the pale of human values America's rulers were throughout this epic event in U.S. history. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and have our discussion.
Why did the United States get involved with Vietnam?
Well, that's not a naive question. It's actually a very profound question. Well, it's a difficult question to answer. One of the pleasures of being retired and having a great deal of time to read things that I want to read and have been wanting to read for a long time, not in the major fields of my work, which were history and sociology of education. So the last 3 or 4 years, I've been reading almost everything on U.S. history, Cold War, wars, war on terrorism, World War II, the atomic diplomacy, etc. And I just finished a book by Gabriel Kolko and Joyce Kolko, his wife, called The Limits of Power, U.S. Foreign Policy, 1945-54. And I'm just finishing a book by Melvin Loeffler on Truman, National Security, and American Foreign Policy. And I've just dozens and dozens of these works. And it would seem to me that if we try to answer this in terms of the perception of those in the American establishment, the John Foster Dulleses, the Dean Achesons, the planners, people in the Roosevelt administration, I think it ranged from the fact that they had a visceral hatred and or fear of revolutionary change, especially in the Third World. They were all anti-communist in the sense that they had opposed any of the revolutionary movements beginning with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. They operated on the basis that Ho Chi Minh was connected to the leaders in the Kremlin. Remember in this period when Ho Chi Minh, when the Vietnamese independence movement developed, Stalin was still in power in the Soviet Union. So that the U.S. felt it had to support the French in Indochina because of a fear of rising nationalism and disruption and unrest, which would undermine U.S. domination in Southeast Asia. This despite the fact that Stalin and the Soviet Union essentially did nothing to help the Vietnamese Revolution until much, much later. In fact, it took almost 5 years for the Soviet Union and China, the People's Republic of China, to even recognize the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. So I think it's really around power and domination that a successful revolution in Vietnam would have taken the Vietnamese out of the international capitalist orbit. The French clearly would not have had power in Vietnam, though, as we know, you know, with the luxury of hindsight, that the United States, of course, eventually in Vietnam and elsewhere, and primarily in China, trades with countries that are formerly communist and or socialist. The U.S. did this with Tito in Yugoslavia. The U.S. eventually ended up with trading agreements and selling wheat to the Soviet Union. The United States has a trade of what? It's maybe $100 billion a year with supposedly the largest communist country on the planet, the Chinese. So I think it wasn't Vietnam itself. It was Vietnam in the larger context. And that Vietnam, as I would argue Cuba in this hemisphere, was partially a test case to make sure that these movements were not to be successful. So the U.S. poured, you know, the U.S. taxpayers poured, well, certainly more than $1 billion down the hole to support the French in Indochina. And some of the deals that I see discussed in these books, of course, is the U.S. is trying to get the French to go along with U.S. plans to rearm Germany and Europe. And of course, it's sort of a quid pro quo. They want the French support in Europe to make sure that the French are going to support what the U.S. wants in Europe. And of course, that meant the U.S. is going to have to support the French, and the U.S. is going to have to support the British, and going to have to support the Dutch and other people who had colonies. And there's no doubt that there was a revolutionary passion and transformation in the air after World War II. And despite the rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence, as Colco argues, the U.S. ended up on the side of the status quo in every place virtually on the planet. So
they were successful in the Congo, but they didn't put the effort into the other places like Mozambique, Angola, where the Portuguese basically carried the ball for a real long time until they had a revolution in Portugal, which led to the liberation of those countries. But the United States was not as in, while they supported them financially, and they didn't get involved as deeply as they did in Vietnam. Even in the Congo, they didn't get as involved as they did in Vietnam. I don't really know why they, I really can't figure out why they ignored these other places. I mean, Vietnam was, resource-wise, it was a much richer area.
Perhaps also the timing. The French, when you think about, you're right, about there were parts of the world, of course, that were dominated by European countries that oppressed their colonial areas, the Portuguese in Africa, the Dutch in Indonesia, the French in Africa, the British in India, elsewhere, Egypt, the Middle East. And the U.S. was able to maintain at very low cost without getting involved when the Portuguese Empire came apart, though the U.S., of course, then got involved later in the 1970s, especially through the CIA and through South Africa and through Israel, by the way, in destabilizing the governments in Angola and Mozambique. Actually, the greatest loss of life in the wars of the 1980s were in Southern Africa. It may have been the timing in Vietnam, because in October 1949, the Chinese communists win, drive Chiang Kai-shek to Formosa, now Taiwan. The U.S. continues to pour money into supporting the French. The Korean War, 1950, 1953, and the argument was then that after the Viet Minh beat the French and the Geneva Accords were signed, at least what I sense from the literature is that the U.S. could not afford in Southeast Asia another loss. They lost, as if somehow we owned China. We lost China. We lost, in a sense, or there was a stalemate in Korea. And by the way, in terms of reviewing some of the materials on the Korean War, which was as horrendous as the war upon the Vietnamese was, the loss of life and devastation in Korea was even greater. Virtually every single standing structure in what is now North Korea was leveled. The bombing was just horrendous, night and day, and the loss of life is estimated at actually between 4 and 5 million people throughout the Korean Peninsula. So some of the writers argue that given that timing for the U.S. to have lost Vietnam, for Vietnam to have gone communist, not only would then add to China's influence, which showed you that the Vietnamese experts in the State Department didn't know anything at all because the Vietnamese and Chinese had been enemies for centuries. But on top of Korea, it would have been a big loss to the United States.
You know, thinking about it, I think maybe it also was like the role of the anti-war movement in this country. It prevented them from going into Mozambique or sending troops into Mozambique and Angola and such, because it would have been too much, I think, for the American people. And the importance that the both the Vietnamese and Nixon and so on played on the what was actually going on in the anti-war movement was that they really couldn't afford it. And that was, you know, that might have been one of the benefits of the anti-war movement, was preventing direct involvement in those countries. You know, I'm not sure.
That's the argument Noam Chomsky's made that argument. I mean, it's been called the Vietnam Syndrome, that because of what happened in the U.S., that the anti-war movement put a brake on what Nixon and others might have done, and that when the war ended, remember that things are unraveling in Southern Africa at the time that the Vietnam War is ending. There is a dramatic upsurge in the world of revolutionary movements, I mean, in Vietnam, in Southern Africa. And also, the Vietnam syndrome, Chomsky and others argue, prevented Reagan and then Bush from getting deeper involved, but especially Reagan, in Central America, in terms of sending large numbers of U.S. troops as they did in Vietnam. They did it primarily with proxy troops, with client troops in Central America. I mean, it was devastating for the Salvadorans, the Guatemalans, the Nicaraguans. But because of the Vietnam War, they could not then ask the American people a few years later to send tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of U.S. combat troops to Angola, Mozambique, and then into Central America. That the U.S., the population simply would not have tolerated it. And that's why they had to do it through the CIA, through Iran-Contra, and these other methods. So, I mean, you're absolutely right.
Thanks for having me here. I believe 1948, they wrote off Africa, correct? Immaterial or unimportant to the United States. It's unimportant to the United States in 1948 in the State Department paper, except for South Africa, was a staunch ally with their mineral. But there's a fear. You had the McCarthyism in the 50s, and even though some of them said they didn't like McCarthy, I think they were still closeting, protecting him very much. They did believe in his views. But if you allowed this nationalism to grow, Vietnam or Korea or Central America, and that's why their hatred for Cuba to this day, that would then put those people in a position, if they became their own government, to say, you have to negotiate with us in order to get our minerals and our deposits. Am I correct there? So it'd be a class war.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what the United States, whether the United States call it the bad apple syndrome, if one gets loose, they're all going to get bad, so we have to squash them completely. So would my argument be correct then, if Vietnam, with its vast resources, became their own negotiating power through Ho Chi Minh, who was a very independent communist, by the way, the United States isn't about to deal with those peasants, per se, saying how much they're going to have to pay for something when we can pay for whatever we want. Would that be a good argument?
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about the argument, the domino theory. I remember, especially during the anti-war movement, that people would argue against the domino theory because it really was a simplistic theory, but there was a truth in that theory. If there are successful revolutions in places like Vietnam and other countries in the world in which those countries decide what will be done with their natural and human resources, and then they'll decide on what terms they will have bilateral or multilateral agreements with the U.S. and with China or with the Soviet Union. This will put a tremendous pressure on the U.S. economy. And what you see from literally thousands of pages in these books is that over and over, the leaders of this country are terribly worried that if this happens, our economy will be shattered. They talk about this in Germany. What if Germany decides to be unified and neutral? I mean, the great fear, actually, after World War II, I mean, they were afraid of concerned about Asia, China, etc. But the greatest fear was that there would be an independent Europe that's neutral, that then might decide to have agreements with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and cut out the U.S. And the U.S. being cut out of all of these potential markets would have an absolutely devastating effect on our economy. So in that sense, the bad apple, you know, it happens in Vietnam, then what happens if it happens in Indonesia and Malaya, then what are we going to do with all this productivity? And this system really would end up choking, I mean, without foreign markets. I mean, we saw that when we discussed the whole issue of World War I and Woodrow Wilson. This system absolutely has to be able to have open markets. I mean, that's what they mean by free trade. And so there's this amazing fear. Same way with Japan. I mean, they're worried about China and Vietnam, but the great fear in Asia, of course, is what's going to happen to Japan. See, if China goes red and Vietnam goes red and then all these bad apples, red apples, I guess we might as well follow that line of reasoning. You have all these red apples in Asia, then Japan's going to have to be cutting some deals because it's going to have markets in those countries. And if it does, then it may not listen to the U.S. And then we're cut out of this immense area. And this system's gone. I mean, this system's gone if that happens. And they were amazing and shrewd. I mean, the deals that were made to prop up colonial regimes and to try to rearm the Germans and the Japanese a few years after World War II. As I read some of this stuff, the U.S. is actually letting the Japanese, who were these beasts a few years before who were killing American boys, the U.S. is making sure that the Japanese in China are not disarmed so that they can block Mao's armies from taking over those regions. The U.S. let the Japanese keep power in certain parts of Vietnam. This is right after they're killing American guys. I mean, it's almost... because the greatest fear was not the Japanese. The greatest fear, of course, is Vietnamese nationalism. I mean, they were not worried about... I mean, they knew Japan was defeated. And, of course, we had our pro-consul there, MacArthur. But the deals that were cut with ex-Nazis and ex-militarists in Japan and the fascists in Italy, I mean, it is really incredible. I mean, you got to hand it to the American rulers. I mean, they'll get in bed with anybody, actually. I mean, because it was their self-interest. I mean, that's why they were doing it. Laura had her hand up.
I want to thank you for mentioning South America, Central America, because while you were talking in the first hour, I had this terrible thought. I thought that Ho Chi Minh was probably responsible for saving so many American lives down the road, and I didn't know if that war inhibited us, but in your opinion, you think that it did, at least during the 80s, inhibit us from sending troops to Central and South America. And I just was wondering, question is when we discuss in the next month, the Reagan years, are we going to be talking about Central America? I haven't read the chapter yet.
I forget what we're...
The Carter-Reagan years.
Yeah. Okay. Carter-Reagan, the reestablishment of American hegemony, which was certainly battered by 19... I mean, think about it, Nixon, Watergate. Nixon resigns, Jerry Ford gets to be president. They have their little deal, and then he pardons Nixon. Carter comes out of nowhere, this humble... millionaire peanut farmer. Nobody knows. Who'd ever heard of Jimmy Carter? Well, he was a gift to us from the Trilateral Commission. And the effort to restore U.S. confidence, U.S. hegemony, restore our faith in the system. Individuals have to go, no matter how big they are. Nixon, Bush. I mean, if Bush has to go, for example, in terms of restoring this system and maintaining its hegemony, folks who are more powerful than Bush will make sure that he has to go. And so it's really under Carter, by the way, the patron saint of human rights. A lot of people forget about the Carter administration. I did a little talk a couple of weeks ago on human rights with a group. And, it was Carter who supported Somoza in Nicaragua and then tried to cut deals and make sure the Sandinistas didn't come to full power. It was Carter who supported the Shah. Okay, this was before the hostage crisis. It was Carter who allowed his secretary at the UN, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who then became senator in New York, to make sure that the UN did not condemn and block the Indonesians after their horrendous invasion of East Timor. It was Carter who approved the largest CIA operation in US history, the arming of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, before the Soviets invaded that country. So the resurrection of this empire, which had suffered a defeat, a crushing defeat in that it didn't win. Chomsky argues that it suffered a crushing defeat in Vietnam, but in many ways the U.S. won the war because it left Vietnam in such a state of economic and human and ecological destruction that the Vietnamese have never been able to come back. And now, of course, with Coca-Cola plants and Nike plants and everything in Vietnam, I mean, millions of people died and all those names on the wall in Washington, so that this, American corporations. So that begins to happen, but enough is still held back to block massive U.S. troops going on the ground in El Salvador and Guatemala, Nicaragua, though the human cost of the people there who suffered just absolute disaster by the death squads that we trained. And in El Salvador, I mean, it's Carter. Archbishop Romero sent a letter to Carter
pleading with him not to send weapons and aid to the government there. Okay, so this is Jimmy Carter, who's done some nice things, you know, building houses with people since he got stopped being president. But if we had a Nuremberg tribunal, he'd be in the docket too. You know, Nobel Prize notwithstanding, when he was president, crimes were committed out of the White House against the people of Central America, against the people of Afghanistan. And we, of course, are living now with the contradictions of what happened in Iran and elsewhere under Carter. So it was, the effort of the U.S. was retarded, was blocked a bit, and all the suffering of the Vietnamese, actually, right, as you said, contributed. Yeah, it's an irony. I never thought about it that way. Actually, it didn't save the lives of the people in Central America, but it saved the lives of tens of thousands of U.S. troops. A sobering thought.
John, a couple of things, but one thing, please. You talked a moment ago about the readings you've been doing and all these deals that you read about American officials, I guess, of the government cutting with. And was it the sense that it was the motivating factor to keep whatever economic foothold and business America already had, or for the promise of getting that? Was that the big motivation in terms of this deal cutting, or was it this thing, we'll side with the Nazis against the communists any day? I mean, was it the communist bugaboo that was really behind a lot of this?
I think both. It's sometimes articulated in actual quotes of meetings because we have tens of thousands of pages of now declassified documents and meetings of the National Security Council and of Truman meeting with Acheson, et cetera, at that time, and then Eisenhower meeting with his officials, and then later Kennedy, blah, blah, blah. For public consumption, it's, of course, articulated that we have to keep freedom and democracy, and there's this monstrous communist conspiracy that's centered in the Kremlin. Okay? The Soviet Union is the real target, even though, and this is what's going to be said publicly before Joe McCarthy comes on the scene, by the way. The real anti-communist purges and other things start under Truman, before Joe McCarthy in 1950 gets up in Wheeling, West Virginia, you know, and says, I have 212, no, 128, no, 57, the numbers drop every day. That was for public consumption, but private consumption, they talked about markets, they talked about keeping things open, they talked about the fear of communism spreading. But at the same time, because again, we have the documents, over and over, the CIA and the National Security Council and advisors admitted they didn't expect the Soviet Union to start a war. The Soviet Union had been devastated in World War II. Its equipment was out of date. They could not stand up to the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. So that they realized the U.S. was much stronger. Our economy was much stronger. We hadn't been devastated. Our resources here in the United States, we were the most powerful country in the history of the world. And so when they talked to themselves, they had a loathing of that system, and they still believe that things were directed from Moscow. But at the same time, there's this contradiction in which they are really worried about the indigenous anguish, for example, in Europe, because of the devastation of World War II, the poverty. There was an incredible winter of 1947. I mean, people are starving in Italy, in France, in Germany, in Britain. They're worried that because of these things, they're not arguing the Soviet Union is going to invade those countries, but of course the indigenous communist parties in those countries, the left, is going to exploit this potential and latch on to the nationalist sentiments. So the U.S., of course, through the CIA and through other deals, always, always, always making sure the left does not take power anywhere. And they were very successful. They crushed, with the help of the fascists in Greece, they crushed the left in Greece. They made sure that the Christian Democrats won this major election in 1947 or 48 in Italy, even to the point of having untold hundreds of thousands of Italian Americans in the United States writing their relatives in Italy, pleading with them not to vote for the communists, which of course was a legal party in Italy, working with the CIA and the mafia in Sicily, especially in southern Italy, to crush and kill people on the left, working with the drug lords in France and Marseille. I mean, so all of this is going on in order to cut deals because they would argue the greater evil, we had defeated fascism and Nazism. The greater evil is in this devastation of Europe, the Soviet Union's going to move in. They already control Eastern Europe, even though a number of quite sober people in the Pentagon and the State Department are saying, you have to understand, the Soviet Union wants a safe cordon on its borders. It's been invaded by Germany twice in the last 30 or 40 years, so we may have to cut a deal with them. They're going to have this, and we're just going to take everything else. So all of that's going on. All of that's going on.
Two quick things, if I may. One thing, that one little incident that kind of reflects the popular sentiment in America at that time, which, you know, this whole, it brings in the racism thing too, which is also something that's going on here in this country at that time and around the world. But there was this whole little weird incident involving the angel of Dien Bien Phu. I just remember this thing while you were talking, and I'm forgetting some of the crucial details, but the main thing was, in that battle, which I guess was in 54, and the French were surrounded by the Viet Minh, and they were forced to surrender because they were surrounded. But within the French fortress, or the compound, was one white nurse. Now, I'm forgetting whether she was French actually have been an American. I'm forgetting that important detail. But she was a woman, and she was white. And she was the only white woman in the place. And so she, it caught hold, in this country at least, as the story, it had Hollywood all over it, but the angel of Dien Bien Phu. And so after the French surrendered, she comes to America. She's given a ticker tape parade down Broadway in New York City. One of these ticker tape parades with hundreds of thousands of people, the motorcade, the whole thing. And this is, I am forgetting the detail. I think she even addressed a joint session of Congress.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I remember that something about...
Right, but there was this, this was something on a popular, it wasn't just deals in the higher echelons of American government, but there was this popular something that America bought, that this was, the French were fighting the good white fight. There's this whole, all these other elements came into play in this thing. But,
and again, at that time and later, when you think about, the French are in Indochina, and they're the French legionnaires and French troops. And of course, the assumption is these are all Frenchmen. Well, many of the troops in Indochina and in other colonial wars were not from France and not from England. They were from the colonies. So fighting in that war in Vietnam were Algerians, who later went to Algeria and used those skills to help fight against the French, and troops from West Africa. And so you had people of color fighting people of color being directed by whites. And I would imagine, I'll have to see if what I can find out about this woman. I imagine, especially if she came to New York and got a reception, she had to kiss Cardinal Spellman's ring. I mean, at that time, of course, nothing moved in New York without Cardinal Spellman, without his say-so, and he was the most virulent anti-communist cardinal in the history of the Roman Catholic hierarchy, and blessed the troops, and loved Diem, and wanted to make sure that the United States won in Vietnam. I mean, it was, even one can imagine any, who knows what happened to any priest or nun in the New York Archdiocese who ever opened his or her mouth about the war. I mean, they were probably sent to, they were probably shipped off to New Jersey. That's what they did to people, I guess. But yeah, I'll have to check, because I'd heard things about the angel of Dien Bien Phu. I don't think she was American, though, but I don't know.
She probably was had this, maybe she, But she was a white woman, helpless. It was almost like a replay of King Kong, those kind of images, in this dark jungle surrounded, there's this one lone, this is a Southern, this is a whole, birth of a nation, this is this whole
right.
stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a good point, because the racism, the contempt for the Indonesians, the Chinese, the Koreans, even the contempt they show for our Koreans or our Vietnamese, our clients, our boys. These people don't know anything. If we're not there to tell them what to do, they're not part of course, they're not part of Western civilization, et cetera, et cetera. And it really goes back in U.S. history. You know, a number of people have argued that, you know, the Vietnam War was just an extension of the Indian Wars in the U.S. The terms they used about Vietnamese, the way they were treated. I mean, I heard stories, you know, from my brother when he came back in terms of, I mean, you know, they'd throw things at people. I mean, the names they called people. They talked about it being Indian country. They were surrounded by Indians. The savagery of that war and the attitudes toward the Vietnamese, the Koreans, and the Japanese in World War II are, I would argue, fundamentally different than the attitudes that U.S. troops and even the U.S. population had toward the Nazis, whose activities in Europe made the Japanese look mild. And the Japanese committed some of the most heinous crimes on the planet, especially in China and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and who thought of themselves as superior to other Asians. So that whole attitude about the Asian hordes, they're peasants, they don't know anything. So imagine if then you have this gigantic country, the most populous country in the world, has a revolution. I mean, it must have been absolutely shocking to people here in the U.S. So that attitude filtered through films that you never found, and you never found it against the Italians or the Germans, who were, you know, they were fascists. The U.S. was fighting against both of those countries. Their prisoners of war were never treated the way the Vietnamese and Koreans, and going back, the Filipinos in that war in the early 19th century. I mean, just horrendous.
John, as I was reading the chapter, if Zinn had put in Iraq instead of Vietnam, he was writing the same chapter. And the people's response against it was worldwide much sooner. And we get some information about rebellion within the armed services. Would you talk about what your feelings are? I know Tom Hayden is leading the movement using what the peace movement learned in Vietnam to see if he can help mobilize against sooner the Iraqi war. But this is, I think, an order of magnitude of criminality. So I don't know whether anything is going to make any difference, but it's too hard to not think about that now. So do you mind if you just think out loud about it?
Sure. I sent an email earlier this afternoon that Pat had sent to me about an article in the Toronto Star in November about the parallels between what was going on in the U.S. in 1970 and what was happening now with the Iraq War in terms of the changing public perception and the anger about the president and the stirring in Congress. We'd say maybe simmering. Who knows if it'll ever get to a boiling point. Of course, there are parallels. I mean, I think in terms of the great imperial empire project, this is part of it, even though, of course, the specific histories of the Iraqi people and the Vietnamese, I mean, they're different concrete histories, of course, and cultural traditions, yet both people dominated by European colonial powers, fighting, I would argue, also a war of resistance, though with a different, certainly different trends and patterns. The Vietnamese movement over decades against the French and then the Japanese. Clearly, I think, a much more disciplined movement without the profound and important factions that we see in Iraq. Well, I was going to say different responses in terms of tactics, because there's the anguish and anger in the U.S. that people are using, you know, they're suicide bombers and they bomb mosques. Some of that did happen in Vietnam. I mean, there were bombings. Though the Vietnamese, of course, had, especially in the north, a long-standing professional army with weapons and planes and tanks that the Iraqis don't have vis-a-vis the U.S. I mean, the terrain is different. But I think fundamentally, it's the same old tragic story of a white Western Christian nation trying to dominate another part of the world, whether it be, yes, oil is important, but it's really about global power and domination, just the way the Vietnamese struggle was. And yeah, the horrendous death toll and misery and a devastation in Iraq. Remember, I mean, this war, I mean, there was no doubt that even though he was given sort of mixed signals in July, or I guess it was July 1990, April Glaspie, the U.S. government, that the Iraqis crossed a defined international boundary and invaded Kuwait, right? That was an act of aggression, and it had to be negotiated and stopped. But beginning with the embargo, a nation that had some of the highest health benefits, educational benefits, and rights for women, without a doubt, in the Middle East, among Arab and or Muslim countries, just a level of destruction that is absolutely staggering. And
savagery, more savagery.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was no question that in 1991 and now that the U.S. militarily, immediately as an invasion, could devastate this country. The occupation is a colonial occupation. And I am sure that the so-called suicide bombers, if they had F-16s and missiles and other things, would use what's at your disposal. I always think when I hear people talk about how terrible this is, and it is terrible because mainly the Iraqis are the ones that are suffering, but if the Iraqis had invaded the U.S., I mean, you don't think some of these good old boys in Alabama and Texas and upstate New York that, you know, guys I know that, you know, had a whole room full of shotguns, M16s. I mean, they would use whatever at their disposal. They would drop bombs. They would shoot people. They would take planes. I mean, they'd use the material things to ward off what they would see as an aggression against their family and their homes, as terrible as the things they are doing.
The equivalent of Agent Orange, which harmed the Vietnamese and their countryside and our soldiers, the equivalent is depleted uranium.
Right.
So we're doing, you know, we go in because we have weapons of mass, they have weapons of mass destruction, and we're doing it, but it's so boomeranging and just keeps going.
Yeah.
Is it more capitalism of war?
There's money to be made, of course, in war. I mean, we think of the Halliburton, Bechtel, the contracts. Well, there's money to be made by some in war. On the other hand, war is an amazing drain, adding incredible debt. I think it's in the World Almanac, in fact. There's a section always on the U.S. economy in the World Almanac and the census. And I remember reading, showing the U.S. debt and how in every war it would jump. Boom, jump, 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 you know, go up, go up, go up. And of course, then the government has to pay for the war, right? They're paying for this war. And reportedly, Bush is going to ask for another $100 billion, which will push it up officially to about $500 billion. I mean, think of that, that's $500 trillion. And that's just the financial cost. And who knows what the long-range ecological costs are going to be. And the long-range costs, you're right, for U.S. troops who have been in this stuff, same way. I mean, I knew someone who, I mean, he was all right, but who was in the Air Force handling Agent Orange in Vietnam, and they didn't, I mean, they just had open containers, and then, you know, they put these things on these, then they were using old C-123s, two-engine slow planes, and they just dumped this stuff all over the place. It was on bases, and a good friend of mine in Ithaca actually has written the definitive book on Agent Orange. It's called An Army Waiting to Die. His name is Fred Wilcox, W-I-L-C-O-X. And he's actually now trying to raise some money and get grants to go to Vietnam. He wants to write a book for an American audience about what happened in Vietnam. And we know the devastation there is even worse from Agent Orange.
First of all, I find it very ironic that the U.S. has had pretty consistently fought against nationalism in other countries. They don't want a nationalistic spirit, etc. And yet, that's what they want here, only they call it patriotism. So they're fighting for others not to have what they want for us here. I think the second thing I see is a big divide between the decision makers and the gum-chewing public. In that, I think one of the things that we're talking about, and I think you just brought it up, is that what keeps coming into my mind and everything that you're explaining and talking about, the bottom line is capitalism. And everything that we're fighting is everything that is not capitalism. And capitalism cannot survive without an underclass to exploit. And so to go around the world and to dominate the whole world, if we're going to survive, we have to have an underclass to exploit or we'll implode. will self-destruct. And so all of the wars and all of the fights, you know, I think that's the key factor. And the decision makers see that on some level, but the rest of the people, they think of patriotism and they think of evil communism and all of that, totally incapable of thinking in terms of the people working together in a common effort for the benefit of all, for the common good. Common good doesn't exist. It's capitalism, and individualism, and you get it for yourself and leave the others behind so you can get it from them then too.
Amen. I mean, there's not much I can add to those fine comments. I guess it's a variation. I mean, it's sort of radical nationalism that's a threat to the American Empire or the British Empire or the French Empire. That is, if there are nationalists, of course, who are willing to play ball with the leaders in the dominant countries, they'll let them have all the nationalism they want, as long as they continue to play junior partner. So the U.S. could play ball with CM and could play ball with Marcos in the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the more radical nationalist, left-wing nationalist, in which people will argue that we'd be happy to have equal relationships with your country and trade, etc., but we're going to determine what we do with the resources of our country, and whether it's oil or tin or rubber in Southeast Asia. That's the danger. And Noam Chomsky's argued that that has always been the fundamental threat to the U.S., especially since after World War II. It was not the Soviet Union. It was the third world, what we call the third world movements. And of course, there was not a hot war between the Soviet Union and the United States. We came close a number of times, and U.S., unbeknownst to most people in the U.S., of course, there have been U.S. pilots and others who were lost on missions over the Ukraine and other parts of the Soviet Union after World War II on secret missions. But the victims of the Cold War were the Chinese, the Koreans, the Guatemalans, the Hondurans, the Nicaraguans, the Iraqis, the Iranians, the Filipinos, the Malaysians, the Indonesians, millions and millions of people. And Coco is especially eloquent on this, that in order to maintain this power, this hegemony, this influence in the world, where that nationalism raised its head and was a threat, it had to be put down. Bribery, you know, if that would work. I mean, preferably people wanted to do it economically, nonviolently, because it's much more efficient. But if that didn't work, we would, as I said, we'd cut deals with the mafia in Sicily to kill people. You know, not something that a lot of guys in the mafia found distasteful, so why not? But we'll do it with the CIA. We've been doing it anyways. What the heck? The drug lords in France, you know, the French connection, the drug lords in the Golden Triangle, the kind of things that were going on that Al McCoy talks about in his book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. And if that doesn't work, it may take actual U.S. troops, which was Korea and Vietnam. And one has to remember that except for our quote-unquote lightning blitzkrieg victory in the Gulf War, the 100-day war in 1991, that the United States has not defeated an enemy of any kind of equal caliber since World War II, all right? Quote unquote, we lost in Vietnam, we were forced to leave, and the Korean War was a stalemate, especially after the Chinese came in. The U.S., the most vaunted, powerful military in history, has only been able to dominate countries like Panama, Grenada, which has a few more people than Santa Monica. I mean, think about it. This is, as I think I've said here, if I were a big supporter of the U.S. empire, I'd really be worried. Gabriel Coco just had a piece on Counterpunch called The Decline of the American Empire. He argued even then, in the 50s, the ability of the U.S. to dominate the world was far beyond our capabilities. Even then, things were starting to unravel. We were just in this amazing place in 1945 and had, despite what people knew about the U.S. and about racism within the U.S. and the U.S. supporting colonial regimes, we had the affection of many people in the world because of what we did to defeat fascism. And wow, that has turned around dramatically in our lifetimes. The world could have been so different had the U.S. moved in a different direction, but it couldn't move in a different direction, and this is Kolko's analysis, and maintain its power economically in the world. It had to give up and to share more and do other things. You can't have both ways, which we will face and our children will face and our grandchildren will face decades and decades of war and terrorism unless this system is changed. And it doesn't seem to be that the people running it want to change this nonviolently, which means it's going to be, there are going to be more Iraqs. We got a couple of more minutes, so let's
I just want to comment on a few things. One, when you said about not cooperating, being a cooperative type of place, well, that sounds too much to them like communism. Yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons they don't want to cooperate with people anyhow.
Cooperation, it's good in kindergarten, but yes. Not running a society. And, I mean, come on.
And, you know, the major difference that we have between Vietnam and Iraq is technology. We can do a lot more with a lot fewer men, with a lot fewer losses. I remember one of the things on the radio was an English soldier had gotten shot 4 times in the helmet and lived. Had no trouble, just, you know, picked himself up and went on. In Vietnam, you'd have been dead.
Yeah.
And these guys are going in with body armor. Who are they fighting? They're fighting people that have some AK-47s and some rusty tanks and plastics and so on and so forth. They don't have the technology. Because I was amazed at first that we had so few losses. Because, you know, the American soldiers know better than any other soldier. I mean, in Vietnam, they showed that. They were always talking, well, the American soldier can fight the Rambo type of thing. I mean, that's, you know, doesn't exist. But if you got the technology to be able to do that kind of thing, to get shot and not die, you're able to do a lot more with fewer. And the technology these days, I mean, they got these helicopter gunships that can devastate a football field in one pass. You know, just everything that are dead because of the machine guns and so on and so forth. So it is different than the Vietnam situation, and it's a lot more horrendous.
Yeah, and maybe, Laura will give you the final word.
Okay. I don't know if this is a final word, but just to address what this nice lady was saying about people cooperating, it's not framed. I've watched a special on PBS, and it's not framed in that way. It was about advertising, but they were talking about politics, too, and they were saying that they're able to frame words and advertising and politics so that you put your alliance in the wrong place. It's not an estate tax anymore. It's a death tax. So you're thinking, and this is how they get you to ally with wealthy people. And it wasn't really the war against Vietnamese people. It was against the war on communism. And it's not the war against the Iraqi people. It's the war on terror, even though the Iraqis are not the people that bombed the Trade Center. So, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, we're not really fighting other people or even other countries. There's these concepts that are put out there to disguise what we're really up to.
Very fine. Thank you. Everybody have a nice, safe holiday, New Year, however you celebrate things. See you in January, and thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. John Marciano's commentaries and discussions about The Impossible Victory, Vietnam, Chapter 18 in Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. The group met on December 20th of 2005. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or johnmarciano@macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.